Hi everyone, David here. Thank you so much for listening to What Matters. We hope you enjoy the show. Before we begin, if you and maybe some of your colleagues would like premium access to the What Matters podcast and want to read or listen to the essential in-depth journalism from Foresight Climate and Energy, make sure to subscribe. You can try us for 30 days for less than €1 a day, which will give you access to our website and app. Just follow the link in the show notes or go to www.foresightdk.com/subscribe to find out more. Welcome to episode 19 of What Matters, the podcast from Foresight Climate and Energy. My name is David Weston, and with me once again are Michaela Hole from Agora Energy Vendor and Jan Rosenau of the Regulatory Assistance Project. Hi team, how are you this week?
Hello. Still overwhelmed by the tsunami of news coming out of energy once again. That's almost the same opening every single podcast, it seems, these days. But living in the UK, we had a whole package of measures announced just yesterday. And then also in Brussels, we have important meetings happening this very moment about the future of the energy market in Europe. So pretty exhausted, even though I had a very nice holiday. Getting used to it. It's gonna be like that for a while, I think.
For me, it was pretty similar. It was never this hard over the summer to decide not to read tweets or energy news, because at some point I felt, you know, I cannot allow myself 2 weeks. You're off completely. You know, you missed the train. But a good summer, anyhow.
Welcome back to the podcast, and hopefully we'll have some really interesting conversations in the next few weeks and months as we get towards the end of 2022. As the energy transition accelerates, the need for qualified engineers and technicians to install the required infrastructure so we can all benefit from the new technologies will become ever more critical. But there is a looming skills gap which threatens the pathway to a decarbonized economy. Our guest this week is Julie Beaufils from European ON, the Electrical Contractors Association, to discuss the issues facing the sector and what needs to be done to avoid delaying the energy transition. Thanks for joining us, Julie.
Hi, Dave. Hi, I'm Michaela and Jan. Nice to meet you.
And you. Thanks for joining us today. All of our decarbonisation scenarios foresee a trend of electrification for end users and increased electrification. Do we have enough electrical contractors at the moment to fill this demand?
Wow, you're going right in the topic. Okay. The very short answer is no. We currently already lack people. For example, our members in Germany, so the German Association of Electrical Contractors, estimated very recently that they are already reporting vacancies for, not finding people for 80,000 jobs in Germany. And that's just as of now. But as everybody's aware here, we have new targets, increasing targets all the time for the installation of new technologies, etc. So this gap is set to worsen if we do nothing. So that's not just 80,000 people in Germany, that's way more in the years to come. And this trend is also a concern in all other European countries.
So across Europe, there must be hundreds of thousands of vacancies just for this particular segment of the market. I mean, if you then think about, I don't know, the installers of solar panels or plumbers who can put in heat pumps, or people who can insulate buildings, there are vacancies all across the supply chain. But what you're saying, Julie, is that just in your sector of electric contractors, we are even just in that relatively small part of the overall workforce, you have these really significant vacancies. That's concerning, I would say. Would you agree?
Yeah, that's extremely concerning. Maybe I think it would be okay. It would be useful if you allow me to explain just a bit what electrical contractors are. Maybe the scope. It's not always super clear. It wasn't for me when I started to work here a few years ago. So electrical contractors represent a sector of people who manage electrical installations. They install and monitor and maintain, etc., everything which is related to electrical installation. So that can be in a house, it can be in a big non-residential building, it's also infrastructures, and it also goes as far as mobility, because electrical contractors are responsible for installing charging points for electric vehicles. And they also do the electrical connection of PV panels, and they install them. So that's, you know, that's a bit of all of that. They also manage smart meters, they install BACs, etc. So everything which covers electrical installation falls under our scope. And when we say electrical contractors, it can be, you know, the main installer, if I can say so. It can be an electrical engineer, and it's also the CEOs of electrical contracting companies. So that's a bit, that's the range, if I can say so. And so, yes, we report vacancies. We are actually quite a big sector. It's almost 2 million professionals across Europe, 300,000 companies. But it's true that many of our issues are shared with the rest of the construction value chain, for example, the mobility value chain in general.
Could I ask a follow-up question? I guess I'm curious. I have two questions. One is, why is there such a big gap? I suspect it's for similar reasons as in other sectors, but it would be interesting to understand why you think in the electrical contractors segment of the job market there's such a big gap in particular. And then also, how long does it take to train people up? Like, do we talk about a few months, years, how can we change the current situation where we have shortages of contractors?
Okay, so you want to solve, well, to mention all the big topics in one question. Okay, I'm trying to do my best there. So why do we have a gap? That's the first question. I think that's the first question that we indeed need to address. We have such a gap for, well, a variety of reasons, of course. One thing that I would mention first, and that's really what we are trying to work on as much as possible here at Europe On, it's the poor image of technical education and careers, because that's what we are talking about. We are talking about skilled people, but who didn't go to university. Sometimes they go to engineering schools, etc. But that's the most common education is to go through an apprenticeship. And well, what we see is that usually all across Europe, technical education is seen as a bad option, a last resort option. I remember being a student in France when I was, 14 years old, you know, our teachers would threaten us to go to technical education if we didn't have good grades. So that's how you go into that kind of careers, basically. So that's the first problem. That's the, you know, the lack of positive image of technical education and careers. So there's a lack of attractiveness. A second issue, I would say, is that in our sector, and I think again that's also true in the construction sector overall, they are mostly small and medium enterprises. In our sector, we even have many, many micro companies or self-employed people. So it's very difficult to hire or to think about upskilling, because you, well, for example, you don't have HR. You know, when you have a company of 3-4 employees, there's no HR, so there's no strategy on how to hire, recruit or upskill people. So that's also a really difficult situation. And another aspect is also that the workforce in our sector is aging. So we have lots of people leaving the sector and not so many joining. I must, you know, just maybe offset this last remark, because we've seen some remarkable efforts made by our members. So they are all national associations of electrical contractors. They tell us that in many countries that the rate of apprentices enrollment is improving in the past few years, but that's just not going fast enough compared to the needs of the energy transition. Then you asked me a second question, but now I can't remember what it was. Sorry.
I think it's how long it takes.
How long it takes. Yep, sorry.
Can you take someone, switch them on and off and ready? No, probably not. How long does it take to retrain?
So maybe, well, first, maybe not to retrain directly. I mean, the most, you know, natural pathway would be to start in this sector first, you know, not retrain from another sector. So in that case, again, varying depending on countries, but usually you would start around the age of 16 and you would go in an apprenticeship for around 3 to 4 years. So that's the average. And then, of course, some people decide to go on upskilling trainings from there to specialize in different sectors, but that's the overall. So it's not super short. And I hear increasingly here in Brussels, you know, there's this appeal for short trainings. Oh, we should have short trainings for people to quickly deliver on the energy and green, on the digital and green transition. Sorry, what we see is that it's mostly a wishful thinking. But it's quite difficult because we are talking about people who are handling electricity. It's a highly hazardous sector. So you have to be really well trained. And so, you know, yeah, there's no such thing as a short training. Sometimes when you already have some technical background, obviously retraining can take a few months. But usually it's really a long process because we want safe workers and safe installations.
So I just read a tweet the other day where someone said, I consider training as electrician because the waiting time for my PV plant is so long. So I guess maybe he would still be better off waiting for a PV plant. It would normally not take 3 years, right? Yeah,
I can imagine this this kind of comment. Indeed, it's taking a lot of time, and what we see is that, well, first there's a shortage in skills, there's a shortage in workers as well, because it's not just about the skills, it's not just about upskilling a few people. We actually need a wider workforce to implement the change. But what we also see is a shortage of supplies. So at the moment, my members are telling me, you know, it's good to communicate on skills and worker shortages because it's a big reality. And that's a topic that we've been, and you know, relentlessly discussing in the past few years. But we also have to keep in mind that there's a shortage in supplies at the moment.
And I would maybe also think that maybe the wages are not as attractive as they could be. You talked already about this reputational issue. But because I always remember that when people worked in a fossil industry, you know, like they had quite competitive salaries at all levels. So maybe that's not exactly the same. I would say they maybe fall more into a more sort of a service category. So maybe we should just offer higher pay also.
Well, I'm waiting for updated figures on the topic, but I wouldn't have such a dark image on wages. First, because, well, the first thing to keep in mind is that workers in our sector earn as they learn. So from the moment you start an apprenticeship, you start to earn some money. Obviously, it's not a full wage, but it's extremely different from the situation of someone going to university who has to pay and who's not earning anything, and then you start working quite early. You have the possibility to become your own boss because we have lots of entrepreneurs. It's really a very entrepreneurial sector. When it comes to, you know, being an employee, you have to keep in mind that every year we have collective agreements and renegotiations on wages. And what we see obviously is that since the workers in our sector are in high demand, the negotiation is definitely more favorable to employees than employers.
There was a new IEA report out this week that says clean energy does provide more employment than the fossil fuel industry. The report also noted that wages across the whole clean energy sector, the wages in that sector were behind that of fossil fuel industry. So this is obviously an average If you're saying then perhaps in the contractors sector it's not so bad, then that's great to hear. Do you think wages and the level of training perhaps is attractive to younger generations? You're saying that if there's a shift in attitudes towards apprenticeships, then we could see younger generations being involved, getting themselves involved in this sector a lot more, where sort of millennials and the Generation Z are also more keen about the sort of the moral function of their job as well.
I think we have lots of very good arguments in the sector because, as you said, more and more young people want to be involved in, you know, climate action, mitigating climate change. People want to move. They want their each day to be, you know, different from the previous one. Not necessarily work in an office in front of a computer. There's also this entrepreneurial sense that I was mentioning just before. There's also, you know, the need to have a long-term perspective, and obviously working in fossil fuels versus working in the clean energy sector. Well, it's easier to make your prospects to have perspective in the latter than the former. So I think we have lots of good arguments, but at the moment it's just not kicking in. So, you know, I think there's a need for more push in that direction. And there's an example that I really like. You know, we all have this image of someone, you know, who went to university or maybe even a business school. They worked in finance or consulting or whatever. And one day, poof, they have a burnout and they want to do something concrete with their life, and they want to change something in the world. And they never become an electrician. They become a florist. They become a baker.
Yoga teacher.
Yeah, a yoga teacher. Yeah, true. Yeah, I was thinking about something, you know, more concrete, because people say, I want something concrete to do, but well, then become an electrician, but somehow, or a plumber, I mean, even, but somehow, you know, it's still not here. And you can hear that I'm a bit frustrated. And obviously we need bakers and we need florists, but we also need people who implement the energy transition. And that's definitely in our sector that you should have a look.
Yeah, it's quite startling when you look at how many people in the fossil fuel industry consider quitting their job. I mean, there are lots of different surveys out there, and I just found one saying that 80% of people employed in the oil industry are now considering to switch job, and many of them think about, you know, the other part of the energy sector, clean energy, renewables, etc. So maybe we need to do a better job in making the case that electrical contracting is a business that will have, you know, a lot of work to do going forward, and perhaps that's not on people's radar yet, and they might look at other more visible parts of the clean energy sector. I don't know. Is that an issue that your people feel more drawn to, let's say, solar panel companies or heat pump installers, because electrical contractors seems to be, it doesn't come to mind straight away when you think about people employed in the clean energy sector, right? You think about technologies more than you think about electrical contractors.
Yes, but yeah, again, you know, being a PV installer or heat pump installer, in the end, it can fall into the same scope because you will need electrical skills. Well, in the heating industry, obviously, you still need a lot of HVAC skills. So that's also a bit of a different scope. But this all goes together, and all of our members are involved in solar panels installation, for example, because, well, there's, you know, there are different types of activities that you need to do from a technical perspective. There's, you know, the mere installation of PV panels on the rooftop, for example, but then there's the whole electrical connection. And again, you know, coming back to short training versus long training, there are lots of discussions on that, like how can we deploy faster solar energy? Well, it's not very long to train someone to install PV, but that's way longer to have those electrical skills. And obviously, if you just have panels on top of your roof, but they're connected to nothing, it won't lead to much decarbonization. So that's all very much rooted together, and electrical contractors are involved in the new technologies that you just mentioned.
We just had solar panels installed before the summer break, and the electric contractor who was on site was here for at least two full days, I think, because he then had to move. We have an EV charger, there's a heat pump, now the solar panel. Like, you're putting all of that together in a relatively small cupboard with a switchboard, which takes a huge skill, and it's not something you can just do yourself, of course, and is as you said, is potentially quite dangerous if you attempt to do any of that yourself. But I was hugely impressed by.
Well, I'm glad to hear that you have the full package then, the heat pump, the EV, the PVs, and yes, again, electrical contractors are really at the core of all of those technologies. They integrate them together, and actually, some of my members are moving away from calling themselves installers. And now they are, you know, they're keeping the I, but it's no longer installers, it's integrators, to really show how we are, you know, at the core of all of those technologies. And again, this should be, I hope, an exciting prospect. But there's still some awareness to raise on here. On
this. Absolutely. I mean, the people who did it, when I chatted to them, I think we were speaking for an hour about renewables, batteries, flexibility, the electricity system. You know, they clearly knew a lot more than just where do these cables go and where do we plug that in. They had a pretty good understanding of how all this fits together. I was quite impressed by them, actually.
That maybe that's the way to go, because you say there's a shortage. So, you know, maybe once they come to a house, and then it shouldn't maybe just be to put a charger into the garage, but maybe, you know, they could do the whole package or prepare the next steps already, you know. There I was thinking of my own experience, because, yeah, we will have someone to come for the garage to install a charging station and the metering station next to it. And I thought, while they're already there, maybe they can already go on the roof and then check if there's a place for a heat pump or something, you know. That they do the whole thing.
That's definitely the kind of service / consulting skills that we are also, you know, discussing internally. That also implies working on soft skills. So another type of skills that we have to work on. But yes, indeed. But again, you know, even if we upskill electrical contractors so they have that kind of expertise and they can provide the whole installation. I want to emphasize that we need upskilling, we need reskilling, but we also need fresh blood. So we need to attract way more people into the sector. And, you know, coming back to this European perspective, what we see is that everywhere we report the same problem of gaps. And we're not the only sector to say that as well. So that's not just a business problem. That's not just the problem of our sector. I think that overall the issue is, you know, it's a systemic issue. It's linked to the way that we look at technical education, apprenticeships, vocational trainings, and we lack a European or national plans, national strategies to make the change happen. Because I came with a few figures for this discussion, and I found those figures that we put forward a few years ago, saying that to achieve the climate targets for 2030, we would need the installation daily of 3,000 solar panels, 1,000 EV charging points, 15,000 heat pumps. That's massive. And we're not able to do that. And even more importantly, those figures are already obsolete, because we did that before the Fit for 55 package was released, before the Russian crisis urged us to challenge our energy transition. So we are absolutely not there. We need a massive awareness raising on the jobs that are needed. And I think the IEA report couldn't come at a better time. Obviously, they didn't plan it for now because it takes a lot of time to prepare such data. But I think it's really great that they are putting under our nose the topic of who will do the job, who will concretely implement the targets that we are adopting at the moment, next week in Strasbourg, etc. So that's really, I think, a blind spot in the Green Deal strategy. Everybody's talking about jobs and skills more or less, but that's always, you know, part of the narrative. And then there's no concrete action and will to implement.
So if you know, Frans Timmermans or Ursula von der Leyen calls you tonight and you know, they ask you, what should the Commission do to help solve this? You know, what can Europe do to address this quite serious bottleneck that you described, Julie, of not enough people to actually install the technologies that we all know we need to deploy in order to meet all those targets and address the energy crisis? What would you tell them? I mean, is there something the Commission can do or maybe national governments can do to unlock this?
Well, yeah, I think that's a huge if Mrs. von der Leyen or Mr. Timmermans called, I think they wouldn't tell me that because they're aware of the big difficulty that we have on labor and skills policies, which are that they are not a European competence. It's not even a shared competence. It's a supporting competence that the EU has, so they can support member states in those policies. And that's the difficulty that we have. And we're not challenging it because our members are very proud of the trainings and the education policies they have nationally. So they don't want a sort of European harmonization. And I don't think that member states would want that either. But we believe that what the EU can do is force member states to make of skills and worker shortages for the energy transition a priority. It's not the case at the moment. What we see is also that this topic is always addressed in silos. So you have the DG Ample, which is working a bit on that, but you know, how does it fit into the European Green Deal? We don't see much, but eventually they will have to question the way they address skills and education policies, because when you are the guardian of the European Green Deal, you have to check each segment of each links of the strategy that you are putting forward. So, I thought it was important to bring a bit of this context. But in a nutshell, I would say that at the same time, the Commission cannot do much or can really start to have a political will on this agenda and say, well, we need to do something so that the energy transition can be implemented at national level. And there are a few things that we've been pushing for in this Fit for 55 package. That's, you know, that's the only occasion, and I mean, that's the best occasion we have for that. So what we've asked to, and respective of the limits and the scope of what the EU can do, is that we are asking in different directives, so that can be the Renewable Energy Directive, the Energy Efficiency Directive, the Energy Performance of Buildings Directive, EPBD, we are asking for the Commission, for the European Union to call on member states and require from member states that they do a regular assessment of the gap between available and needed professionals for the energy transition. So let's say that every 2-3 years, they have to put forward a report showing how many workers we have, how many workers we would need to achieve our targets. For example, the targets which are defined in the national energy and climate plans. And we believe that obviously it's just a report, you know, it's another report, but we believe that if member states have the obligation to really look into that, they will realize the massive gap that we believe there is between achieving climate and energy objectives and not achieving it. And we hope that this will confront them with this reality and put forward plans and strategies at national level. So that's the key aspect. We actually received a lot of support from members of the European Parliament. And I do hope that this will be adopted in the votes that will take place next week in Strasbourg on the Renewable Energy Directive and the Energy Efficiency Directive. Of course, the next step is to convince the Council to work on that. But that's the key ask that we have. And I think it's, again, reflective, and it's reflective of the IEA report that you were mentioning, because they also say that the first step is precisely assessing the needs, and then we can build something from that. And, you know, it's now that I'm working more and more on this topic within Europe on, it really drives me a bit mad to think about the potential of green jobs that we can create and the tremendous number of young people that we can attract in those sectors. Not everybody is bound to go to university, and it shouldn't be seen as a punishment. It shouldn't be, you know, a negative thing to go into technical education. And I think that national governments should really take this topic and say, well, we built a strategy for green jobs. We can create that many jobs, and together, we will, thanks to you, we will be able to achieve our climate targets. We will be able to build a sustainable future. That should be, you know, obvious, but nobody really wants to talk about technical education. That was a bit long. Sorry.
Hi, everyone. David here again. Just a reminder that you and your colleagues can get premium access to the What Matters podcast and all of the in-depth journalism from Foresight Climate and Energy by subscribing. You can give us a try for 30 days for just €29, where you can access our website and audio app. Go to www.foresightdk.com/subscribe or follow the link in the show notes. Now, back to our conversation. No, not at all. Not at all. So let me hark back to Jan's question there. If then perhaps Olaf Scholz or Macron or even Liz Truss or someone like that came to you and said, what can we do to improve technical education and improve the number of trainee electricians? What do you want to see happen? And do you see any appetite for that amongst national governments?
I think there's some appetite. We start to see some interesting things. So again, I'm happy to, you know, suggest a few things, but I think also that it will depend from one country to the next, because the general problems are the same, but then, you know, how do you address it? It's different structures. We see some interesting things. For example, just a few days ago in Sweden, the government gave the National Energy Agency the task of coordinating a sort of national effort to find skills for electrification. So here we really see this link between, you know, the energy agency working on energy matters and the skills issue. So we see something happening here, and I know that our Swedish members are very happy with this development because it's taken at very high level and very seriously. We've seen also an interesting bill that was passed recently in the UK saying that regularly, so I'm not sure if it's every year or a bit less than that, but regularly from now on, every student primary school and in the following levels will have to be presented with, you know, technical education and technical careers. They have to raise awareness on those options. And, you know, it seems like very symbolic, but I think it can change many things. So that's another interesting aspect. And then obviously there are many good ways to work on this agenda. For example, there's the need to invest more in training centers and schools, vocational schools, because there's a lack of teachers, there's a lack of facilities, there's a lack of updated equipment. So that's the first thing. Another aspect is to provide equivalence between university and technical education. So, for example, rating them the same way into education rankings, or also enabling someone who's been in technical education to go to university and vice versa. That's something which already exists in some countries, and in others it's not the case. And we feel that maybe students would feel more confident if they know that they can change ways, pathways easily. And another thing that I found quite interesting during the beginning of the COVID crisis was that in Denmark they decided. The government decided to increase their support to companies to hire apprentices, even though lots of businesses were shut or people had to reorganize. And they increased the support, and it actually led to a higher enrollment of apprentices. So that's a few ideas, and of course there's no silver bullet, I think. You have to look at different options. But overall, again, I'm really convinced that having national strategies on the jobs needed for the energy transition, with a look at technical education in particular, would be the best way to move
forward. Julia had another. One of the things that dropped over the summer and interrupted the summer break was this Inflation Reduction Act in the US, right? I had a look at it, and I spotted something that I'd never seen before. So they work with the tax credits, and then you had a more interesting or more preferential tax rate if you fulfilled certain conditions around apprenticeship and education. And I'd never seen this before. I mean, you saw in the press these things like the electric car has to be assembled in the US, where you immediately cried, "Ooh, WTO, help, this is not good." But these provisions on basically obligating the clean energy companies to somehow invest in education, I felt it was actually quite interesting. I'd never seen it. I don't know if you've looked and if you know a bit more about it, but it struck me as a rather elegant way of bringing the topic in.
No, I've not heard about that. And I think it's indeed interesting. We are in contact with the American Association of Electrical Contractors, NECA, and they have similar problems with us, but the education structure is completely different. So we try to learn a bit from each other, but there's a barrier to translating the needs and the situations. What I've seen, for example, I think it goes a bit in the same direction as what you're suggesting, and I think it was in Germany, but I'm not 100% sure, is that in some tenders, if you want to submit an application in some tenders, for example, constructing a big non-residential building for offices or a mall or whatever, then you would have to prove that you have certain trainings with new technologies, or that you are accredited on certain types of lists. So that's also a way to make to provide additional motivation to have the latest available technologies expertise.
Is that another barrier, though? Is the rate that the technology is advancing, and specifically with the rise of digitalization, particularly in the sector, and the different interfaces between all the different technologies, is that perhaps a barrier for many people to enter the sector?
Yes, and not just to enter, but to provide the latest services. Like you can work, maybe you've worked in the sector for 30 years, but now you cannot offer services which are linked to digitalization, for example, doing some energy management, providing energy management services based on reading a smart meter, that kind of things, because you're not skilled for that. So that's definitely a barrier. What we see is that COVID had actually a good impact on this, because everybody was forced to improve their digitalization, their digital skills at a fast pace, and that's really something that we see. And another aspect that I find interesting is that with our members, we also try to work on the efficiency, well, not the energy efficiency for once, but just the efficiency of workers. How can we work more effectively so that we can do more work in limited time? And that's particularly relevant when you are on a work site, because you have to coordinate with all sorts of trades, and lots of things are still happening in person or are still done with paper. So really doing this leap into digitalization can really help to go faster. And obviously that won't solve the workers' shortages issue, but if we can work more effectively, we lose less time in non-essential tasks, and we can focus on the most important things.
Is there a role for sort of larger companies? I'm thinking maybe the Siemenses and the Eons and the people that are kind of bringing out this new technology. Is there a role for these companies to help upskill and retrain and train the workforce in general with these new technologies?
Yes, definitely. I know that many big electrical companies and manufacturers have their own trainings. They have lots of programs. I think it's definitely part of the answer. But we, more than projects here and there, we also need real strong strategies to move forward.
And what about the sort of maybe the gender disparity in the sector? I presume still many electrical contractors are. It's fairly a male-dominated sector, particularly. Is there any efforts or any action towards sort of introducing people from other genders into the sector?
It's a particularly severe issue in the installation sector, well, in the construction sector as a whole, but in the installation sector in particular. I don't have average European figures on that, but I think that we're not really above 10% of women in our trade, and even in what we consider more progressive countries such as Scandinavia, I was a bit shocked to see that there are not so many women. However, it's definitely a discussion that we're having with all of our members. I don't know where it started, but I think that this need to be more, to attract more women, actually also came from this workers shortages issue that we discussed. Because when you complain that you don't have many workers, and half of the population is female, maybe it's time to open up to women. So that's definitely a topic which is discussed a lot. There are lots of actions starting or which have started in the past few years. For example, I'm really interested in a campaign which was launched last year by our Finnish members, along with other associations in Finland, where they are trying to raise awareness on the sector overall, but with a specific target to attract women. And their objective would be to receive as many applications from men as from women by 2030, which is really extremely ambitious, even for northern countries. So there are lots of discussions, there are lots of reports and actions which are undertaken. It's a very complicated topic, because it's true that we see technical careers in general and installation in particular as mostly male. And I would say that the difficulty is that you have to fight on so many fronts at the same time, because you need to challenge the preconceptions not only of students from an early age, because we see that that kind of decision going into university versus technical education, it's actually something which starts from a very early age. So you have to target students, but you also have to target parents, teachers, even not non-technical teachers. I mean, just teachers in you know, in primary school, etc. Before they tell you that you should not go to technical education because you have bad grades, etc. And then you also have to challenge the views of colleagues in the technical sector and recruiters. What we see is also that sometimes recruiters, you know, don't treat the same way female versus male applications. So it's, you know, there are so many directions where we need to change preconceptions. That's very complicated. It's a very slow process, but we are seeing every year a bit of progress. But yeah, it's really taking a lot of time. I will say one last thing on this. I find it really telling. Again, many things are decided from a very early age, even though it's non-intentional, it's not, you know, conscious. And I was reading this study done by our Swedish colleagues, where they say that when a young girl is playing with Lego, for example, you know, because it's a girl, she will be considered as creative. And if she was a boy, she would be considered as manual. And, you know, that's just how it starts, you know, because then from there she will be directed towards creative, artistic careers versus manual and technical careers.
I would like to ask you a question about the current energy crisis, if I may, Julie. We touched on this already a little bit in the discussion, but your sector must have been impacted by this massively, as every other sector has. Could you explain sort of how, in your industry, the energy price crisis is playing out? Like, what's been the impact of that?
It has many effects and many diverging effects, I would say. First, just being a business, obviously, we are hardly hit by the inflation. And we have lots of very small companies. So that's particularly hard on them. So that's, you know, just by being a company, and obviously you need energy to work, etc. So that's playing a role. And I was talking with some of my members recently who told me that their businesses, some of them were returning as much as possible to working from home to save some energy costs. So that's, you know, that's the first thing, as any business can expect. And, you know, even before the energy crisis, we already suffered from the supply shortages because everything is delayed, postponed, etc. And then there's this mixed effect of the crisis on our business, because on the one hand, it's actually reinforcing our role, because we are the ones who can deploy electrification, clean energy. We have lots of services to provide in the field of energy efficiency. So that's even more necessary than before. We have some members who provided recommendations to their national governments on, you know, short-term actions to take, for example, you know, installing heat pumps, that kind of things. So that's, you know, that's the, well, I wouldn't say positive, but the aspect which really, yeah, strengthen our position and our role in the sector. And on the other hand, we don't really know where the energy transition is going, because at the moment we are talking a lot about quick fixes, superseding Russian gas with other gas supplies. So, you know, are we putting a halt on the energy transition or not? That's also a big question. And with the inflation, lots of clients are also postponing or cancelling orders. So it's very difficult to have a clear view on where the sector is going at the moment.
I just have one last question. Do you see an impact coming if the demand is there, is created? So you mentioned the number of sort of solar panels that need to be installed and the number of heat pumps that need to be installed every day. if that demand is actually created and there are these people calling out for people to install their heat pumps, will that have an effect on the number of electrical contracts that there are? Will that encourage more hiring and more people getting involved? Or so is it that, or is it also just the training side of things that needs to be addressed?
No, I think it goes hand in hand, because you can have this wheel of training people, but if there's no market on the other side, then you just train people for no reason. Something that many of my members say is that they need more predictability, because I don't know if you remember that. Well, I was not in the sector at that time, so I don't. But back in the beginning of the 21st century, there was a sort of hype for solar panels, and so lots of people trained. And what we saw, for example, in Germany, because there was a lot of public support to install solar panels. And then in 2011, I think, public support stopped or was reduced. And then there was a big drop in the demand for that kind of installations. And we had lots of people who were trained for it and who didn't have anything to do anymore. And actually, I think that back in those times, there was a higher level of installation than now in terms of solar panels, which means that we can do it. But obviously, you need a bit of predictability. You need to be sure that the market is going in this or that direction, so that then you can invest in training the right number of people. So it goes hand in hand.
Absolutely. Just as we come towards the end of our time together, Julie, I'd be really interested if you could look into your crystal ball and just look at what the energy landscape looks like in 10 to 20 years' time. What's your predictions for that?
Okay. So Europe On is part of an alliance which is called the Electrification Alliance. So we are 10 associations in this group. Maybe I won't mention everybody, but there are some very well-known associations such as Eurelectric or Solar Power Europe or Wind Europe, Avere, etc. And with the Electrification Alliance, we have this campaign which is called Electrify Now. And we are looking at whether we electrify now or we electrify later, because we believe that it's coming anyway, but massive differences will result from taking the right actions now or later. So for my crystal ball, I think that there are really two different options. It's a strange ball. There are two balls actually. And so I think that if we look at now and at the Russian crisis that we have, a big threat is to focus only on now. And I mean, I do understand that we need to have a safe winter, obviously. But if we start building all the infrastructure and rerouting all gas supplies towards Europe, then we won't pay much attention to the energy transition. And we can play this game over and over again every winter, because every winter there will be something. Gas suppliers may not be the most reliable countries. So that's, that's the pessimistic crystal ball, where we didn't electrify now, we waited. And there's the optimistic crystal ball, saying that we need to cater for this winter and next winter, obviously, but we also speed up on the energy transition. And by 10 or 20 years, we can really have a completely different situation where Europe is way more sovereign and sustainable.
Absolutely. That's really interesting. I think having an optimistic and a pessimistic crystal ball, I think lots of people might have those at the moment. Finally, then, before we go, I'd just like to go around the table and ask what caught your eye this week or in the last couple of weeks. I'm sure there's been plenty, but maybe if there's one thing that really stood out. Michaela, what caught your eye?
Picking up a little bit on what Julie just said about where do we go, which turn are we taking? I saw someone tweeting in the aftermath of this new massive support package that the Germans adopted. When was it? A week ago or something. And it included also one-off payments to pensioners of 300 euros one-off. And then she calculated that you could use this money and offer 2 million heat pumps to households. I haven't done the math, Jan. Maybe you can do a quick, you know the prices better. I was shocked. I still, before using it, I wanted to see again if that I trusted that's up. So now we only need Julie's people to install the 2 million. But no, basically all of this to say that I think it's really about time we start shifting from supporting the use of energy and put the money into measures that reduce them. Because otherwise, as Julie said, it's not this winter, it's the next and the one after and the one after.
Yeah, definitely. Jan, what caught your eye?
Well, I saw a piece in the Washington Post earlier this week about Poland and the efforts in Poland to move away from gas after the invasion of Ukraine by Russia, and what's happening on the ground in Poland. So I think it's a great read. It kind of uses personal stories and explains people's motivations and why they want to move away from gas in their individual homes. So that's my recommendation for this week.
Absolutely. And if they want to hear more, they should listen to our podcast on Poland and Eastern Europe from a few months ago as well. Julie, what caught your eye?
So that's a very light piece of news, but I'm very fond of polar exploration, North Pole, South Pole, and I'm working in the electricity sector. So I don't know, I guess that sponsored posts are very well done, because what I saw was a sort of ad from one polar institute in Antarctica saying that they were recruiting electrical installers because they need them in polar stations. And I just thought, well, that's another inspiring reason to go into the electrical contracting sector, because you can really make the difference in incredible environment. So that's something that I would keep in mind.
Absolutely. That sounds amazing. Finally from me then, I saw it was an image shared on LinkedIn by Alessandro Blasi, a special advisor at the IEA, detailing the supply chain of solar panels and how dominated it is within China, how the polysilicon, the cells, the modules and the wafers, all of the supply chain are 75% based in China or more. Wafers are 96.8%, it says on this thing. It just goes to show how dependent we are on China in that sector and in many others, and how much more other areas could do to hopefully try and build those sectors themselves in order to diversify slightly. I just thought it was really interesting. I didn't realize, I knew China dominated, maybe not quite to that extent. So really interesting image, and we'll make sure we link that below in the show notes. That's what we.
This must be the first time you did not report wind news.
It is. I've gone for solar this week rather than wind. There's plenty I could have done on wind, I'm sure, as well. And of course, we also could have discussed the energy package in the UK, and we mentioned Germany as well, and Europe. So lots going on at the moment. That is all we have time for today. My thanks to Julie, Michaela, Jan, and our producer, Anna. If you have any thoughts or questions about anything we said on today's podcast, you can reach us on our Twitter accounts. I'm on @DaveWForsyth. Jan?
I'm on Jan Rosenau.
Michaela?
@CitizenSane1.
And Julie?
I'm @EuropeOn _EU.
If you have any questions for the team, you can also tweet the show @WhatMattersPod or email us show@WhatMattersPodcast.com. I'll also throw in a little plug for our new podcast, Policy Dispatch, with our policy editor, Sam Morgan. The first episode went up last week, so do check that out as well and listen for more. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you all next time. Thank you.